Agitation, Reverses, and Progress. Chapter 2. Victory of the Pope. While these events were taking place in Spain, Rome herself appeared to be assuming a more serious character. The great patron of music, hunting, and festivities disappeared from the pontifical throne, and was succeeded by a pious and grave monk. Leo X had been greatly delighted at hearing of the Edict of Worms and Luther's captivity, and immediately, in testimony of his victory, he had consigned the effigy and writings of the reformer to the flames. It was the second or third time that Rome had indulged in this innocent pleasure. At the same time, Leo X, wishing to testify his gratitude to Charles V, united his army with the emperor's. The French were compelled to evacuate Parma, Piacenza, and Milan, and Giulio de' Medici, the Pope's cousin, entered the latter city. The Pope was thus approaching the summit of human power. These events took place at the beginning of winter 1521. Leo X was accustomed to spend the autumn in the country. At such times he would leave Rome without surplice, and, what was considered still more scandalous, wearing boots. At Viterbo he amused himself with hawking, at Corniti in hunting the stag. The lake of Bolsena afforded him the pleasure of fishing. Thence he passed to his favorite villa at Maliana, where he spent his time in the midst of festivities. Musicians, improvisatori, and all the artists whose talents could enliven this delightful abode, were gathered round the pontiff. He was residing there when he received intelligence of the capture of Milan. A great agitation immediately ensued in the villa. The courtiers and officers could not restrain their exultation, the Swiss discharged their carbines, and Leo, in excess joy, walked up and down his room all night, from time to time looking out of the window at the rejoicings of the soldiers and of the people. He returned to Rome, fatigued but intoxicated with success. He had scarcely arrived at the Vatican when he felt suddenly indisposed. "Pray for me," said he to his attendants. He had not even time to receive the Holy Sacrament, and died in the prime of life, at the age of 45, in the hour of victory, and amid the noise of rejoicing. The crowd followed the pontiff to the grave, loading him with abuse. They could not forgive him for having died without the sacrament, and for leaving his debts unpaid, the result of his enormous expenses. "You gained your pontificate like a fox," said the Romans. "You held it like a lion, and left it like a dog." Such was the funeral oration with which Rome honored the Pope who excommunicated the Reformation, and whose name serves to designate one of the great epochs in history. Meantime, a feeble reaction against the spirit of Leo and of Rome was already beginning in Rome itself. Some pious men had there established an oratory for their common edification, near the spot which tradition assigns as the place where the early Christians used to meet. Contarini, who had heard Luther at Worms, was the leader in these prayer meetings. Thus a species of reformation was beginning at Rome almost at the same time as at Wittenberg. It has been said with truth that wherever the seeds of piety exist, there also are the germs of reformation. But these good intentions were soon to be frustrated. In other times, a Gregory VII or an Innocent III would have been chosen to succeed Leo X, could such men have been found. But the interest of the empire was now superior to that of the church, and Charles V required a pope devoted to his service. The Cardinal de' Medici, afterwards Clement VII, seeing that he had no chance at present of obtaining the tiara, exclaimed, "Elect the Cardinal of Tortosa, a man in years, and whom every one regards as a saint." This prelate, who was a native of Utrecht, and sprung from the middle classes, was chosen, and reigned under the title of Adrian VI. He had been professor at Louvain, and afterwards tutor to Charles V, by whose influence he was invested with the Roman purple in 1517. Cardinal de Vio supported his nomination. "Adrian," said he, "had a great share in Luther's condemnation by the Louvain doctors. The cardinals, tired out and taken by surprise, elected this foreigner. But as soon as they came to their senses," says a chronicler, "they almost died of fright. The thought that the austere Netherlander would not accept the tiara gave them some little consolation at first. But this hope was not of long duration. Pasquin represented the pontiff elect under the character of a schoolmaster, and the cardinals as little boys under the rod. The citizens were so exasperated that the members of the conclave thought themselves fortunate to have escaped being thrown into the river. In Holland, on the contrary, the people testified by general rejoicings their delight at giving a pope to the church. Utrecht planted, Louvain watered, the emperor gave the increase." Was the inscription on the hangings suspended from the fronts of the houses? A wag wrote below these words, and God had nothing to do with it. Notwithstanding the dissatisfaction at first manifested by the people of Rome, Adrian VI repaired to that city in the month of August 1522, and was well received. It was reported that he had more than 5,000 benefices in his gift, and every man reckoned on having his share. For many years the papal throne had not been filled by such a pontiff, just, active, learned, pious, sincere, and of irreproachable morals. He permitted himself to be blinded neither by favor nor passion. He followed the middle course traced out by Erasmus, and in a book reprinted at Rome during his pontificate he said, "It is certain that the Pope may err in matters of faith, in defending heresy by his opinions or decretals." This is indeed a remarkable assertion for a Pope to make, and if the Ultramontanists reply that Adrian was mistaken on this point, by this very circumstance they affirm what they deny, viz., the fallibility of the popes. Adrian arrived at the Vatican with his old housekeeper, whom he charged to continue providing frugally for his moderate wants in the magnificent palace which Leo X had filled with luxury and dissipation. He had not a single taste in common with his predecessor. When he was shown the magnificent group of Laocoon, discovered a few years before, and purchased at an enormous price by Julius II, he turned coldly away, observing, "They are the idols of the heathen. I would rather serve God," said he, "in my deanery of Louvain than be Pope at Rome." Alarmed at the dangers with which the Reformation threatened the religion of the Middle Ages, and not, like the Italians, at those to which Rome and her hierarchy were exposed, it was his earnest desire to combat and check it, and he judged the best means to this end would be a reform of the Church carried out by the Church itself. "The Church needs a reform," said he, "but we must go step by step. The Pope means," says Luther, "that a few centuries should intervene between each step." In truth, for ages the Church had been moving towards a reformation. But there was no longer room for temporizing. It was necessary to act. Faithful to his plan, Adrian set about banishing from the city all perjurers, profane persons, and usurers, a task by no means easy, since they formed a considerable portion of the inhabitants. At first the Romans ridiculed him. Soon they began to hate him. The sacerdotal rule, the immense profits it brought, the power of Rome, the sports, festivals, and luxury that filled it, all would be irretrievably lost if there was a return to apostolic manners. The restoration of discipline, in particular, met with a strong opposition. "To succeed in this," said the Cardinal High Penitentiary, "we must first revive the zeal of Christians. The remedy is more than the patient can bear, and will cause his death. Beware lest, by wishing to preserve Germany, you should lose Italy." In effect, Adrian had soon greater cause to fear Romanism than Lutheranism itself. Exertions were made to bring him back into the path he was desirous of quitting. The old and crafty Cardinal Soderini of Volterra, the familiar friend of Alexander VI, Julius II, and Leo X, often let fall hints well adapted to prepare the worthy Adrian for that character, so strange to him, which he was called upon to fill. "The heretics," remarked Soderini one day, "have in all ages spoken of the corrupt manners of the court of Rome, and yet the popes have never changed them." "It has never been by reforms," said he on another occasion, "that heresies have been put down, but by crusades." "Alas," replied the pontiff with a deep sigh, "how unhappy is the fate of a pope, since he has not even liberty to do what is right."